Chapter 8, A Heart That Loves Him Supremely. Several years ago, a fellow came up to me at church and said, "Chuck, I want you to have a new car." I laughed. "I never buy a new car," I replied. "Too much depreciation. I let someone else take the loss." He didn't give up. "I own a dealership here in Orange County," he said, "and I want you to come over and pick out the car you want. I'm going to take the depreciation off the price. I'll give it to you at my cost, and you can pick all the options you want. I'll even put them on." So I went to the dealership and picked out my dream car, all the options General Motors offered, and the color I wanted. He sent the order into Detroit, and GM built the car. Soon he called me to say, "Your car is here." Immediately, I went over to pick it up. I turned in my old used car and drove out of the dealership with a beautiful, brand new convertible. I'd never owned a new car, and the fragrance was all mine. That special new car smell belonged to me. As I drove out of the dealership, I just knew that everybody was watching me. It felt like people's heads turned to look as I passed by in my fancy new car. Oh man, it was nice to drive. All the way home, I kept praising the Lord and worshiping Him. "Lord, You're so good. Wow, this is outrageous. I love it. You are so good to me, Lord. I love You." Before I had left for the dealership, my wife had asked me to pick up some milk on my way home, so I stopped at a grocery store. As I walked down the aisles, I kept praising the Lord. I just knew everyone in the parking lot had to be admiring my new baby. Man, I was so enamored by it. "Oh Lord, You're so good. I love You so much. Lord, this is glorious." I paid for the items and almost skipped back to my new honey. And there I saw some inconsiderate nincompoop had carelessly and recklessly put a ding in the driver's side door of my dream car. And I hadn't even gotten her home yet. Enraged and determined to get even, I set to work trying to recover some tiny paint scraping. I hoped to play detective and determine the color of the assault vehicle. Maybe it's still here in the parking lot and I can pound on somebody. All the way home from the store, I fussed and stewed. I felt miserable, absolutely miserable. Rotten people, rotten world. I hate people. I just hate them. Inconsiderate loots. Boy, you can be glad I'm not God. I would have sent half the world to hell in the last second. At home, I yanked the groceries into the house. My son Chuck Jr. said to me, "Hey, Dad, did you get your new car?" "Yeah," I grumbled. "Oh, I want to see it," he exclaimed. "Sure," I grunted. So I took him out to the car, where he put the top up and down and did all the push-button things, windows, seats, the whole nine yards. Then as he stood back to admire her, he paused and asked, "Oh, Dad, what's that?" My nose flared as I said, "Would you believe that was when I was in the market? Some stupid, dirty, rotten," and I started to launch into my whole little tirade again. Chuck cocked his head at me slightly and said, "Hey, Dad, it's all going to burn." Whatever I had intended to say next died in my throat. What could I say? He was absolutely right. "Thank you, son," I replied quietly. I needed that. How quickly I'd lost perspective. The shininess of the new car, its luxury appointments, the admiring looks I'd received. I had allowed those things to take my focus off the only truly priceless treasure in the universe. I had gone from, "I love You, Lord," to, "I hate the worthless people You created," in about 0.003 seconds. How easy it is to say, "I love You, Lord," as you're styling down the street in your hot new set of wheels. Ah, but loving Him supremely, whatever comes. I find that I still have a ways to go on that one. Did you know that Jesus never turned down an invitation to dinner? It's true. Every time in the Gospels that someone asked Him to dinner, He accepted. Jesus loved eating with people. In fact, sometimes He even invited Himself. During a visit to Jericho, for example, a short man named Zacchaeus climbed a tree to get a glimpse of Jesus. The Lord stopped right beneath him and said, "Hey, Zacchaeus, come on down, because I'm on my way over to your place for dinner." Even in the last book of the Bible, Jesus closes out His messages to the seven churches by saying, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him." Why does the Lord so love eating with people? It's because He loves the close kind of intimacy that happens only when people share a meal together. One day a Pharisee named Simon asked Jesus to come for dinner. While we don't know the reason for his invitation, we do know Simon was a rather ungracious host. In those days, since people wore open sandals on dusty roads, most hosts would have a servant waiting at the door with a basin of fresh water to wash each guest's feet. If you could not afford a servant, at least you provided some water. Simon didn't even offer that. As guests entered the house, the host would lay his hand upon his friend's shoulder and give him the kiss of peace, often touching both cheeks. It was considered common courtesy. Simon did not do that either. Next, the host would put a drop of rose perfume upon the head of each guest. This gesture lent a lovely fragrance to the atmosphere and said in a practical way, "Let's have a beautiful time together." Nor did Simon do that. Most houses of that era were built around a courtyard, a good place for feasts. Guests sat on the floor around a low table, leaning on their left elbows with their feet behind them. As they reclined, they used their right hand to eat. Whenever someone invited a rabbi to dinner, they always left the door open for the public to come in. Uninvited guests could stand around the outer circle and listen to the rabbi. On that particular day, a streetwalker came to the dinner uninvited. The Greek term used to describe her identifies her as a prostitute. That's how she made her living. She came and stood behind the master to listen to him speak. As she stood there, Jesus' very presence did something in her heart. She became very conscious of her sin, and she began to weep, sobbing over her sinful state. As her tears began to fall near the feet of Jesus, she knelt down and began to wipe his feet dry with her hair. And then she began to kiss Jesus' feet and dab them with some perfume she had carried with her in a little alabaster box. Luke describes what happened next. "Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, 'This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner.'" You should understand that the Pharisees were very careful not to touch sinners. They thought that somehow sin could be transferred by a mere touch. If they should accidentally bump into a sinner, they would rush to the spring of Gihon, remove their clothes, and take a ritual bath. They wouldn't approach the temple grounds until they had cleansed themselves. They so hated the thought of even touching a sinner that when they walked down the street, they wrapped their robes very tightly around them. They couldn't take the chance that a swishing robe might touch a sinner or a woman or a Gentile. This explains why the Pharisees saw Jesus' willingness to be touched by a known prostitute as conclusive evidence that he couldn't have any special relationship with God. Yet Jesus knew his thoughts and said, "Simon, I have something to say to you." "Teacher, say it," Simon replied. Jesus then told a story about a man who had two debtors. One fellow owed the man $50,000, while the other owed him $5,000. While neither borrower could pay what he owed, the lender wrote off both debts. "Tell me, therefore," Jesus said, "which of them will love him more?" "I suppose the one whom he forgave more," Simon answered. "You have rightly judged," Jesus said. Today, we understand that Jesus intended to draw a spiritual parallel between these fictional financial debts and our own spiritual debts. Some people sin more than others. Some are very moral, always trying to live by the golden rule. They try to be honest, a person of integrity. Sure, they sin, but not much, by comparison anyway. Meanwhile, others break nearly every rule in the book. They make the sinner's top 10 list and get recognized in the Guinness Book of World Records. But no matter where you might land, whether you sinned a little or a lot, you are like the man in Jesus' story. You have no funds with which to pay your debt to God, nothing to redeem yourself from your sinful state. Your spiritual bank account reads zero. Jesus used the story to call Simon's attention to his own discourtesy. "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil." Luke 7:44-46. Jesus did not speak like this simply to rebuke Simon. Rather, he had an important point to make. "Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little." Jesus did not announce how much Simon loved, but you can probably guess. Are you the one who loves much or loves little? Where do you stand? Sometimes it's harder for good people to receive the grace and goodness of God than it is for bad people, because the good ones, like Simon, often don't recognize their need. And thus, when God forgives them, they love only a little. Have you ever noticed that we don't even want to see God forgive certain people? We think they're just too horrible. We consider their crimes so heinous that we recoil at the thought that God might want to forgive them. Several years ago, after convicted mass murderer Jeffrey Dahmer was converted in jail, newspapers across the country printed irate letters from readers who railed at the idea that he might have accepted Christ while in prison, as reported. How could anyone even suggest that such a monster could be in heaven? Some people went so far as to say, if that animal is in heaven, I don't want to be there. Did you know that Charles Tex Watson of the infamous Manson family has made a profession of faith in Jesus Christ? I've had the opportunity to visit with him in prison. I correspond with him regularly. He is a glowing witness for Jesus Christ and a tremendous love for the Lord. He's been forgiven much, and so it is quite possible that his love far exceeds those who refuse to even acknowledge his faith as genuine. If you know God has forgiven you much, then you love much. If you can imagine God has forgiven you little, then you love little. So then, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you rate the love meter in your heart for the Lord? Is it slight or fervent, large or small, red hot or icy blue? Do you love him much or love him little? Many people lose out on their relationship with the Lord at this very point. They love the Lord, yes, but they love him only a little. Their interest in other things exceeds their interest in the things of the Lord, and thus they enjoy much less of a relationship with God than what he desires. God says that your love for him is to exceed all others. In Exodus, he describes himself as a jealous God. He wants your love for him to rise above all other loves in your life. Your love for him must reign supremely. The Apostle Peter learned this lesson in a way he would never forget. On the night of Jesus' arrest, Peter denied even knowing the Lord. Afterward, he sank into a depression and perhaps thought his time as a disciple had ended. But then the risen Jesus sought out Peter to reaffirm his love for him and to give the grieving apostle another opportunity to express his love. Early one morning, on a lonely stretch of shoreline on the Sea of Tiberias, Jesus made breakfast for Peter and six of his buddies who had been fishing. After these men had recovered from the shock of seeing their Savior alive again, Jesus invited them all to eat. And after they had finished eating, he posed a crucial question to Peter. "Simon Peter, son of Jonah," Jesus said, "do you love me more than these?" Just what did Jesus mean by these? That's the question. Since the text doesn't make it clear, we can't be dogmatic. Maybe Jesus was looking at those freshly caught fish flopping in the net. No doubt Peter loved fishing, as most commercial fishermen do. And so maybe Jesus was asking, "Peter, do you love me more than your old life of fishing?" Or perhaps Jesus was looking at the other disciples when he asked his question. At the Last Supper, you'll remember, Jesus had predicted that all of his men would desert him. Peter had boasted, "Even if everyone else abandons you, I never will." It's as if he had said, "Jesus, I love you more than the rest of these fellows. While they may fail you, I never will. You can count on your boy, Rocky. I'll be there when you need me most. These other guys might be a little flaky, but you can trust me." So perhaps Jesus was referring to Peter's boastful self-comparison with the other disciples. We don't know what Jesus referred to when he asked Peter, "Do you love me more than these?" But we really don't have to know. The far more important question is, what are the these in our own lives? What things compete in your heart with your love for Jesus? Does your love for those things exceed your love for Jesus? Or does your love for him rise above all other loves? Is your love for him paramount? Everything else can go by the wayside. Nothing matters as much as your relationship with God, and he calls you to love him supremely. Suppose Jesus was having breakfast with you this morning. Imagine that he set down his fork and looked you straight in the eye. If he should say to you, "Do you love me more than these?" To what might he be referring? What's competing with him for your love? With many people, it's a relationship, perhaps a romantic attachment to an ungodly person. Perhaps she's asking you to compromise your standards, or maybe he's pushing you to go to bed with him. You love this person and don't want to lose him or her, but do you love him more than your relationship with Jesus? Are you willing to sacrifice your relationship with God in order to continue your relationship with her? Or maybe Jesus is asking you about the these of your career. You've set high goals and standards for your life. You're on the way to fulfilling your desires to create a secure financial future. Maybe the opportunity has finally come for that promotion you've been hoping for. But you know that this new assignment may require questionable business practices. You've been told that at this level, you have to do some unsavory things in order to keep the clients happy. Jesus might well be asking you, do you love me more than your fondest ambition? Do you love me more than those goals or the fulfilling of your dreams? Of course, there's nothing wrong with having moral relationships and activities and possessions you deeply enjoy. There's nothing wrong with fishing or romance or pursuing a career. These things become wrong only when your love for them exceeds your love for the Lord. When they become the greatest love in your life, when you become willing to sacrifice your relationship with God in order to indulge these other passions, then they have ceased to be good for you. Jesus asks you today, do you love me more than these? Or am I somewhere down the priority list? Does your love for me exceed all other interests and all other loves in your life? Am I first? Do you love me supremely? It's easy to glibly answer, Lord, you know I love you more than anything else in the world. Peter did that. But when it comes down to practical realities, is that just an empty profession, or is there real weight to it? What does it mean to love God supremely? Jesus made a startling comparison in Luke 14 that both clarifies the issue and confuses a lot of readers. If anyone comes to me, he said, and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, he cannot be my disciple. Luke 14:26. You see the problem, don't you? Here we have been talking about the love of God and loving Him supremely, and now Jesus starts talking about hate as a good thing. Fortunately, the problem is easy to overcome. We struggle because here in the United States, our word love and hate lie at opposite extremes. They are opposed to one another. In the Middle Eastern mind and thought, however, they serve as comparative words, not opposite words. So Jesus is not commanding us to hate everyone who means a great deal to us. In fact, He's saying that our love for them must pale in comparison to our love for God. We should love God so supremely that any other love looks like hate by comparison. You can be sure He's not instructing you to actually hate anyone, because the Bible explicitly commands the contrary. Love your enemies, Luke 6:27. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another, John 13:34. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church. Ephesians 5:25. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. John 15:13. Obviously, Jesus is not saying that to follow him you must hate your mother and your father, your sisters, your brothers, your family members, your children, and your friends. He is saying that your love for him must exceed your love for your mother, your father, or your wife, or your children, or your brothers and sisters, or your friends. Your love for him must reign supremely. And that means if your parents tell you it's either your love for Jesus or your love for us, then you must choose to love Jesus. If your wife says, I'm not going to stay with you anymore if you insist on this Christian obsession, then your love for Jesus has to exceed your love for your wife. If your husband says, I can't stand this religious stuff anymore, if you keep it up, I'm leaving, then you must let him leave. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians, if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases. Your love for Jesus has to be first and paramount. Matthew's gospel makes this intense comparison very clear. There Jesus says, He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So don't worry that to love God supremely you must start hating your wife, kids, and anybody else you hold dear. Not so. God instructs you to love them, and through His Spirit, He enables you to do so. Nevertheless, your love for the Lord must rise above every other love. It sounds pretty extreme that Jesus would say your love for God must make your love for friends and family look like hate, doesn't it? How radical. And then Jesus goes the extra mile. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Now he says you're to love him even more than you love yourself. That's really loving God a lot, isn't it? Once more, we know he doesn't mean you need to literally hate yourself. In the first place, that would be impossible, according to Paul, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For another, Jesus himself quoted part of the great commandment like this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. God assumes that we all love ourselves. That's how He's designed us. Nevertheless, our love for ourselves is to seem like hate in comparison to our love for God. And what are we to think of his statement about the need for a true disciple to bear his cross? Many ridiculous things have been said over the years concerning this idea. You probably heard someone say, "I have a mother-in-law who really likes to nag. I hate it every time we have to go to her house, but I guess that's just the cross I have to bear." No. No, that's not the cross. Or if someone else says, "I have this arthritic toe, and I guess that's just the cross I have to bear." No, in the life of Jesus, the cross represented a total submission to the will of the Father. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prayed, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup, the crucifixion, pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Matthew 26:39. That's the cross. The cross is the complete surrendering of yourself to the will of God. Such a total surrendering of your will might involve suffering. It might involve pain. It might even include your premature death. And no one will ever willingly make such a choice without first nurturing a love for God that exceeds all others. Without such a love, such discipleship cannot exist. With such a love, it cannot help but exist. It's a choice. Some people may respond, "Well, that sort of passion is fine for people who are built for it. Great for them. But God didn't put me together like that. Frankly, it's beyond me." You want to know a secret? It's beyond me too. Frankly, it's beyond all of us, in the natural. Left to ourselves, none of us could love God like this. But in His love, God doesn't leave us to ourselves. He sends His Spirit to live inside of us, so that we might start living beyond the natural, in the realm of the supernatural. When we try to love God in our own strength, the Bible says, "Are you not carnal and behaving like mere men?" But when we choose to live by the Spirit, it says to us, "Keep yourselves in the love of God." You see, God loves you, and because He loves you, He wants to bless you. He wants to bestow His goodness upon your life. Unfortunately, it's possible for you to get out of the place of God's blessing, just as the children of Israel did through unbelief. Their sin kept them from entering into the full blessings that God had intended for them. In a similar way, through pride and rebellion against God, you can keep yourself from the full blessings that God wants to bestow upon you. So Jude instructs, keep yourselves in the love of God. It's a choice. God will never say, "Would you look at the way he's living? I won't love him anymore." No, God will still love you, but he weeps over your sin. He won't do for you what he wants to do when your life becomes inconsistent with his nature and his ways. Like Cain, if you allow hatred to fill your heart, God can't bless you. Like Balaam, if you allow greed to fill your heart, God can't bless you. Like Korah, if you allow jealousy to master your life, God can't do for you what He really wants to do. So keep yourself in the love of God. Keep yourself in the place where God can do all He wants to do for you because of His infinite love. Remember my shiny new convertible? The beauty that someone dented before I even drove it home? It turns out the thing really did burn. Years later, I got a letter from the Department of Motor Vehicles asking if I knew anything about that car. As soon as I got a free moment, I called the DMV to say, "Sorry, I sold that car years ago." A state employee on the other end of the line replied, "Well, it's been abandoned on the highway. The engine blew up on it." As I put down the phone, I could almost hear the words that the Lord spoke to me so many years before. As I drove home from the market, steaming, I had felt Him asking me, "Where's all the joy and the glory and the blessing and the love that you were talking about just a few moments ago?" One little ding on now a burned-up car had sent me from, "Oh Lord, you're so good, I love you so much," to, "God, I hate people." Had the Apostle John been riding with me, he might have tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Chuck, I hate to tell you this, but I think you're a liar. Because anyone who says, 'I love God,' but hates his brother is a liar." 1 John 4:20. We prove our love for Jesus by obeying Him, and He has said very clearly, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." Dings on new convertibles or not, consider it drivers or not. Do you love me more than these? Jesus wants to know, does your love for me reign supremely? Only you and He know the answer.